By the age of 30, I'd sold that for a seven-figure sum, which was wrong. Guys, what's going on? We get another episode of the Wantrepreneur Podcast here. First guest that we've had on that's been in CRO or just a noted CRO kind of expert, Oliver Kenyon here. Oliver, we've got an accelerator of early stage entrepreneurs, people who are getting involved in business. A lot of them obviously dealing with CRO problems on their website. Some also agency owners who maybe trying to branch out and maybe offer that type of service to their clients. For people who are unfamiliar with you, can you give like a quick 30-second intro as to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. So Oliver Kenyon, I am co-founder of an agency called ConversionWise. We have been in business for 12 years. I am a chef, fully qualified chef turned online entrepreneur.
Nice.
I've been online for probably now 20 years and one exit and an agency that I now run all around conversion rate optimization.
Cool. So we like to ask people just how they got started in entrepreneurship in general. So did you have a career prior to becoming an entrepreneur? What was your first business? How did that kind of come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a fully qualified chef, as I've mentioned. So I went to school, as everyone does, and I wasn't the best at school. I wasn't like a naughty kid. I wasn't interested. So I kind of class clown, messing around with friends. I just had zero interest in education. Just wasn't for me. So the only thing I knew how to do was cook, because from the age of 13, I got a job in a pizza kitchen, thanks to my auntie, Italian restaurant. So cooked pizzas. And it was the only thing I was half decent at. Like I say, sport and football. I wasn't a bad footballer, but education just wasn't for me. So I used to work in the kitchens and go to school. And at the earliest possible convenience, I dropped out of school. And my parents were like, okay, you can drop out of school, but you need to go and do something, which is fair enough. So they almost forced me, but I'm glad they did, to go to culinary arts school, so like chef school. But I was lucky enough to get in on the third year because I'd already got a load of experience. This was like age 17, 18, but I've been working in the kitchen since I was 13.
Nice.
But on the side of that, what it allowed me to do is, because it wasn't in my hometown, I had to move out and then I didn't have friends in this new city, and I was there for a year. So I was in this kind of student accommodation. And it really allowed me to have some spare time and I first started going online, believe it or not, through hip hop. So I used to love old school hip hop, days of Eminem, 8 Mile, rap battles. And I first went online to view these rap battles. People would do them online. I became obsessed with it. And I was on communities, forums, like old school forums. Most people listening to this will be way younger than I am. But back in the day of before Facebook groups, Discord, Slack, school, there was like things like V-Bulletins, M4O. And I used to go on these rap forums. And one day I thought all these guys were like beefing on these forums, but they were all from different forums. So you had like rapmusic.com, rapbattles.com, and they would all like come onto each other's forums, like each other's turf and beef. And I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to create my own forum for a middle ground where all the rap forums can battle in a middle space. I did the whole kind of, I think, Shark Tank, Americans call it, we have a Dragon's Den. I did that whole pitch to my grandfather and father, and I said I need £180 it was for a year's worth of hosting, a domain and a V-Bulletin license to start the forum in return for 40% of my company, which luckily they gave me. I started this community, and within that community I found someone from Wales, I'm in England, who did affiliate marketing, and he introduced me to affiliate marketing. And that was really, now that's the kind of elevator top level look at it. There's loads of intricacies in that. There's loads of failures, business failures, different forums, communities, stuff that I started in between. But he introduced me to affiliate marketing, which is where I made my first bit of money online. And then I started an affiliate marketing community, which I never, ever started to monetize. But it turned out to be the project that actually took me from full-time chef to, at the age of 26, entrepreneur. And then by the age of 30, I'd sold that for a seven-figure sum, which was really cool.
Cool. So for people who are unfamiliar with affiliate marketing, can you just break down like what industry? Because I think that should cover like a lot of different things in people's
absolutely.
Minds.
Affiliate marketing can evolve around any industry, but effectively what it is, it's like a partnership marketing. So it's really when you have a product, whether that's a physical product, a store, a course, a membership, whatever it may be, and you want to sell more of it, you then get affiliates, effectively people, okay, who will promote it on your behalf, and you'll give them a commission of the sale. So let's say I have a pair of shoes that I want to sell, and I'm selling them for £100. I would recruit some affiliates who I know who could sell those shoes. And for every pair of shoes they get, they sell, I give them £20. I keep £80.
Got it.
That's how it works.
So are you doing that mostly for like lower ticket sort of e-com stuff? Or is there, because I've done affiliate marketing. That was also like my kind of foray into marketing like 10 years ago.
Oh, wow, cool. Yeah.
But I decided I was doing like kind of traffic arbitrage. Do you know what I'm saying? With the literal affiliate links. I forget the website. There's some big website for affiliate marketers. I'm blanking on the name.
ClickBank maybe?
ClickBank, or... yeah.
ClickBank, yeah.
So that was a while ago now. But so what types of offers are you pushing? Or what are the main marketing
sources? this was years ago. But when I first got into affiliate marketing, so I don't do it anymore. I run my agency. But when I was doing affiliate marketing... we were pushing all sorts of lead generation or e-com. So, for example, we were partnering up with some guys in the space and running things like solar leads, funeral cover leads, home insurance leads. And then on the e-com side, things that were big back then were like all the kind of fitness products. Keto berries, they all have their fad of the next weight loss product. Like, these were huge in the affiliate space, but I didn't do too much of the actual affiliate marketing itself because the affiliate community took over. So where I made my first real money online was running the community, which is now the largest affiliate community online, which is really cool.
Nice. So you were talking about selling your company. What was the circumstance? We've interviewed a lot of people that have gone through an exit process or multiple exit process. Was it something that you wanted to do or something that kind of came about organically? Were you planning to sell originally when you started the company, or it was something that
came up? I started the company, I honestly didn't have a clue I could make money from a community. So I love communities, forums. Communities are my kind of like, I guess, hobby or passion. But when I started it, so this is what I mentioned, that was the kind of 100-foot view. If you zoom into it, I started maybe 5 or 6 communities before that community that failed and never made a penny. Yep. Affiliate marketing just happened to be quite a high ticket space, because if you find it as an affiliate network, if you find an affiliate that's, they call them super affiliates, that person can make you maybe £100,000 a day. So it's a real good space where you can actually make a load of money through advertising for affiliate networks. Yep. I never started the community with the view of making money. I never knew I could. But I started to then generate revenue, and it took me probably 6 or 7 years to get that company to a stage where it was very attractive to a buyer. And I'm going to be really transparent with you. I don't mind sharing the story because hopefully it inspires people.
Okay.
I left chefing when I was 26, and I didn't have too much money. The affiliate marketing just started to make more money than I was making working ridiculous hours as a chef. So I took the plunge. And when I left the chefing job at 26, I turned around to 2 people, my wife, actually 3 people, my now wife, my partner back then, Josie, my best friend and co-founder in ConversionWise, Andy, and my mentor, a guy called Adam Toran, amazing guy in the States. And I turned around to these 3 people and I said, I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Now, back when I was younger, I'm 35 now, maybe 36, 35. So this was nearly 10 years ago.
Okay.
£1 million, don't get me wrong, is still a hell of a lot of money. But everyone back then was like fixated with that £1 million. Kids at 18 are selling apps for £1 billion. It's crazy. Yeah. But back in the day, £1 million was like the kind of
big deal.
The whole thing. Yeah, exactly. So I had this goal in my head, and I don't particularly believe in manifestation, but maybe I proved myself wrong in that disbelief. But I told those 3 people and no one else. And I worked tirelessly on this site day and night for those 4 years solidly, and the reason I sold was because 3 or 4 months before my 30th birthday, and probably longer, 6 because it took 3-4 months in due diligence, but maybe 6 months before my 30th birthday, 2 or 3 companies actually approached me out of the blue. 2 companies approached me out of the blue about acquiring the site. It's called affiliatefix.com. you can check it out. Still exists. About acquiring the business, and I entertained them. But what I did do is I told my mentor, a guy called Adam. Now, Adam went and spoke to some of his partners who he thought may be interested, and managed to broker me a better deal, which overnight, before I was 30, made me a millionaire. And once those things aligned, I thought it was almost too good not to. It was one of those things where it's like, my gut is telling me I need to sell because this ticks that box and proves me right from 4 years ago when I told these three people I was going to become a millionaire by 30. So it was really cool nice. For me, for sure.
So divine sort of inspiration there.
Yeah, but I would definitely not say that I was any way smart enough or clever enough to even think I could monetize the business, let alone view to sell it in the future. Now I think I'm a bit more savvy in business, where if I start another business, I would definitely have an exit goal in mind. I would do forecasts. I would know who my ideal buyers were, all of those kind of stuff. But that's taken years to get to that stage for sure.
Nice. Cool. So I guess getting into the CRO space, from when you got started with affiliate marketing, however many years ago, like how has the game of CRO or landing pages, and how has that kind of all changed since like maybe 10 years ago?
Yeah. So when we started getting into the whole CRO space, we were predominantly in the landing page design side of things. So I kind of think there's two sides, and that's why we split our company into two solutions. If you're doing under, say, 100,000 visits per month to your website, you're best focusing on best practices and designing landing pages around conversion principles. If you're doing over 100,000 sessions per month on your website, you should be doing A/B testing, which is like ongoing CRO. But when we started, for the first 8 years in business, we were actually called the Landing Page Guys. So we actually named ourselves Landing Page Guys on purpose, because we wanted to be like in everyone's mind when they think of, oh, I need a landing page guy. I need a landing page. Who do I call? The Landing Page Guys. So we became fixated of becoming the very best and biggest landing page agency, where we came up with these frameworks of high conversions. And it was only probably 2-3 years ago that we rebranded to ConversionWise and focused on the other side of the business, which is the ongoing CRO A/B testing. So definitely things have changed. I don't think the principles around building a high converting website have changed much. I think obviously with new app advancement and technology advancement, definitely things change. Everything obviously shifted to mobile probably like 4 or 5 years ago and put a massive emphasis on mobile first. But as far as the principles that go into building a high converting website, it's basic user psychology. It's things like trust, social proof, handling objections, removing friction, usability. These are basic human thoughts and processes and things that you actually just have to make sure work on your phone and devices, versus the industry itself, I don't think changed as that much. Yes, there are advances in tech. Obviously, AI has had a big influence, but I still think you need that human interception on using those tools, like you do in most things, right?
What do you, just a sort of random question, I think it's relevant to our audience, but let's say a lot of our companies are like SaaS or B2B. They don't have like massive visitor traffic coming to their website. They have high ticket offers, people coming in, potentially booking a meeting or a purchase. Do you, like, if you're using like a lead pages or an unbounce, do an A/B testing, do you need a lot? Do you look at this really statistically, where you need a lot of data to make optimizations, or could you do it off qualitative information?
You could do it off qualitative, but obviously quantitative data talks. So data is important if you're doing A/B testing, because you need that data to quantify a test. You need enough of a sample size to say that is statistically proven to convert better. However, for the businesses that are doing SaaS, B2B, high ticket, if they're not if they don't have enough volume going to their site, there's still some big things you can do. So if you're using lead pages, unbounce, etc., I would be taking bigger swings. So what I mean by that is I would be doing what we call a traditional split test. A split test is where you split one site versus a completely different looking site. So this is where I would talk about best practices. And there are frameworks. We've written a lot of them. You can find them in our academy. But there are frameworks that are basically around, if I am selling a SaaS product, what is the best layout for my landing page? If I am doing lead generation, what is the best layout for my lead generation? And that's taking us 12 years to advance, and lots of data from our clients' campaigns to say, this is best here, this is best here. Again, ticking all those boxes around value proposition, creating irresistible offers, social proof, trust and credibility. So if I was in your kind of audience now, and I'm thinking, okay, I want to get my website converting the best it possibly can, but I'm only doing 1,000 hits per month, that's where I'd be taking a bigger swing. I would be creating a version B of your website that was based around all of these conversion principles and best practices. And then you can split the traffic between the two.
in terms of those best practices, like how big of a difference is, like we deal with companies that are in like very specific niches, fintech, or even a sector of fintech, like prop tech or something where it's like real estate, commercial real estate. Like how is the human psychology principles for the design of a site, is that very general across niches, or do you find that there are best practices that work better for an info product versus an e-com?
There definitely is best practices that work better per niche. But 9 out of 10 principles will convert across any product, any niche, because again, it's human psychology. Whether you're selling a £1 million plot of land or a 30 quid SaaS, there typically will be questions that people will have, obviously maybe a bit more in the £1 million plot of land, but there'll be questions that people might have when they visit your site. Now, the way to handle those objections is to have an FAQ on your site that answer the most commonly asked questions. So that's tick straight away. Whether you're buying a 30 quid piece of SaaS or a £1 million piece of land, you still, if you are being targeted by a cold ad or you don't know that brand, there's still a trust and credibility factor that comes in with that. I don't trust you even if I'm spending 30 quid with you. Obviously, there again, it's just a heightened factor on the £1 million pot of land. So yeah, there are definitely principles that go across. However, apparel is always one. We have a lot of clients who sell clothing or apparel or jewelry, and you wouldn't have the same kind of scarcity and urgency and big headlines and flashy, not flashing, but like flashy kind of graphics on those types of pages that you would on, say, an info product that was like more of a biz hopper, impulse buy, low ticket with a countdown timer. You have to be careful, of course you do, but I think a lot of it comes down to common sense. If I was, one exercise that everyone can do and a lot of people don't do is put yourself into the mind of your consumer, so your target demographic.
Simulate it a little
don't
bit.
Don't think as a business owner, because as business owners, and I'm guilty of it, and as advertisers, we're all so proud of our features and our shiny objects. We want to just shout about, we've got this, shiny. And you think that because of the terminology around your business, your offer, that you can put that on your website and everyone's going to understand. But you have to step back and think, if someone saw this business and know nothing about us, can they understand? There's that 5-second rule. If I show this to a stranger at the above the fold section on my website, if they don't know what we do within 5 seconds, then you've lost that customer. So you need to sometimes just dumb it down and just speak about the benefits, the outcome, the transformation, the outcome to your consumer, as opposed to, we're the best because of this. It's no, we can get you this result. This is the outcome that you're going to get. And that's way more powerful.
A follow-up question on that. When you're using like Google Analytics, GTM, or whatever you're using to, do you optimize off of the end outcome, so the purchase, or like the intermediate step that they take, going to the cart or booking a call?
Yeah, great question. Really great question. So we work primarily in e-com, so it's relevant. Typically, we'll ask clients what their kind of goal is. And it is good, especially when you have lots of data, to take it to the micro. So do add to cart. But what we typically will look for, and everyone gets this wrong, most people will go off conversion rate and they'll be fixated of, I've got X amount of conversion rate, I need
it's really
higher.
Yeah. That matters.
It's more, we refer to RPS or RPV, so revenue per session or revenue per visitor. Because we have no control on the back end, unless we get full access to our clients' COGS and what margin they're making, all we can optimize is how much money are you making per click on your website. So yeah, our revenue per visitor is pretty much the kind of gold mecca in CRO when it comes to e-com.
Got it. If we're looking at, let's say, a company who's got doing significant revenue, they're venture-backed, like how should they select? Like, should they hire internally for somebody to do CRO? Is it important to have somebody on the team to do it? Or how do you think they should go about it, being an expert in this?
If I said yes, then my co-founder would shoot me. Running a CRO agency is a bit of a trick question. But no, I think where we've tried to position ourselves is we want to be your house team externally. We want to be an extension of your team. But the real answer to that is, it's not always as easy as just finding someone who's a senior CRO player and hiring them and trying to get results. Where you benefit from having an agency is CRO is way more than just an individual. Okay, to do CRO effectively, you need a data analysis, you need a designer, a developer, a QA, you need the correct software, you need then someone to run the test. We then have seniors above those people to check those tests. And you need someone who's got experience with running multiple tests across multiple verticals, multiple niches, multiple departments. And that's where an agency, I feel, will actually get you better results. Again, the benefit of an agency is you're not employing that person, you're not paying their 401k, you're not paying their sick pay. They have to turn up and they have to perform. And we all know it's difficult to fire someone. It's very easy to fire.
Yeah, outcome dependent. So it works out better for them anyway.
It's performance based, yeah.
Exactly. Are you like generally just an optimization focused guy? Like you were talking about your wife before. Were you optimizing the Tinder, Hinge profile? I saw that Zuckerberg.
I'm way too old for that. I think. I don't even know if Tinder was around. In my days of dating.
Match.com situation.
I think I was like, plenty of fish. Plenty of fish. I think I was 23 when I met my wife. So we've been together a long time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
12, 13 years. I'm married 4, 5, maybe. I'll get shot. But no, am I an optimized person? No, I'm a very simple person. So,
gotcha.
You know, I'm very lucky that I have, I guess, two co-founders. I have two beautiful daughters at home and an amazing, beautiful wife. And she's my co-founder at home. And then I have a co-founder at work who's Andy. And what I have done, and I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but I've optimized those relationships so that they are both amazing at what I am awful at. Right. So my wife takes care of the home. She is incredible at home. She's raised our daughters to be these incredible little girls. And on the other side in business, I have Andy, who is honestly amazing at everything I'm not, and I'm I'm okay at everything he's not good at. So I have optimized my life to focus on what I think are my strengths and what I am good at. And now we run a team of 46 of us. Andy is very good with people. I'm not the best with people. Andy is very good at ops, processes, that side of things. I'm very good at sales, marketing, innovation, driving the company forward. That's what I excel at. Do I optimize my life? Maybe self-consciously, but I'm very lucky that I found these two people in the biggest pillars of my life that are just the other side of me. They're amazing at things that I'm not that great at. And I'm very lazy to those things.
Yeah, most of the founders that I've talked to that are far, far along, they have that sort of cognition about both their co-founder, business partner, and their home life. I've just found that like having that knowledge of like your weaknesses versus strengths and filling it in is a major thing.
Huge advocate of leaning into what you're good at and delegating the rest. And if you can find a co-founder who does that, admit what you're
family co-founder
at and let them a family or business. Admit that you're weak at it and let them excel at it for sure.
Cool. So I guess tying everything together, for do you recommend what's your like biggest takeaway for entrepreneurs? Do you know what I'm saying? What kind of goals are you looking at in your entrepreneurial sort of outlook now?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me and my journey now, and obviously bear in mind that I'm 15, 20 years into this, it's all about what's next. I always have to have something. So I'm not a huge believer, as I said, in manifesting, or I'm not a huge believer in having this 10-year goal. I always have to have something. Yeah. And I'm not against it, by the way. I know it can work. And I have that almost in the back of my head. I always have the next. But where I work very well and what really helps push me forward is having the next thing, whether that's, you know, a number by the age of 40, or whether it's to achieve enough to buy the next house. People come, we're very blessed that we have a lovely house, but people come to our house and they're like, oh, is this your forever home? And I'm like, no, because I would be doing a disservice to myself and my family if I said this was our forever home, because I have to always be driving towards the next thing. So like, I'm not saying that's 20 years ahead. I never look more than 2-3 years ahead, because I always just want to drive to what's achievable next. That's what pushes me, is like what's achievable next, not what's achievable. I'm not one of these people who thinks I'm going to be a billionaire in 20 years. I think I can maybe double my net worth in 3-4 years. That's my realistic kind of, and that's what people are different, but for me that's what drives me.
Makes sense. Cool. Who's the best fit for you? Who should look into conversion wise?
Absolutely. Any business that typically is generating some revenue, we service both sides. So as I said, if you're under 100,000 visitors per month, the best thing you can do is have a high converting landing page or website designed. And that's what we do better than anyone. We've been doing it for 12 years and have designed more landing pages than any agency on this planet, which is amazing. And then on the other side, if you're an e-com brand or someone who's doing over 100,000 sessions per month, then we can definitely help you with ongoing CRO, increasing that revenue per visitor.
Nice. Cool. Oliver, thanks for coming on. And also, is Twitter the best avenue like for you to follow your teachings,
etc. Yeah, Twitter's good. We put a lot of content out there. So just at Oliver Kenyon. And thank you so much for having me.
Cool. Thanks, Oliver. This is the Wantrepreneur Podcast.
Are you ready? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome